Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers, with Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome to the second episode of the Commentary Track, coming to you this week as a sustaining feature. This is your obedient servant, Frank Thompson. And I'm delighted that you've come back for a second helping after last week. This week, as promised, I actually have a guest, film producer and distributor, Thomas W. Holland, who I've known for a long, long time. And we'll talk a little bit about that and talk about film topics in general. Tom and I have worked together many times. And oddly enough, in this conversation, we don't talk too much about our mutual projects, but we do go over some of this stuff, and I think you'll find it interesting, and it's, to me, it's just a conversation with an old friend, much like I have had with him hundreds, nay, thousands of times. I'm excited that this week is the second episode, which means only 98 more, and we get that big syndication money. I'm excited about that. I've decided when I get my huge syndication check, I'm going to buy one of those bicycles with a big front wheel. I've always wanted one of those. A couple of people have written to me. When I say a couple, I mean 50, after last week's episode, and mentioned that periodically in the background they heard a rooster crowing. Guilty as charged. There is a rooster who lives next door to me. In fact, when Claire and I were looking to get a house in this neck of the woods, we immediately saw that there was a rooster living next door, and oddly enough, that attracted us to the place. He was a very interesting-looking fella, and his name, believe it or not, is Pecker, which I believe must be a nickname because, really, no mother would name her son Pecker. But that's this rooster's name. And you won't hear him probably during this introduction or probably the outro because I'm recording this late at night as opposed to last time when I recorded it during the heat of the day. And so you got a lot more traffic noise and you got Pecker chiming in with his peculiar ways many, many times. Once he's on a roll, he will crow once every minute on the minute. And although he's some yards away and have all the windows closed and a directional microphone, still, Pecker will find a way. So probably won't hear him tonight, but in upcoming shows, he's going to be a constant presence and probably will just end up being my co-host. I asked his owner, who's a very nice fellow, lives next door, if he would take a picture so I could post it on the website so you could all know what my friend Pecker looks like. Speaking of the website, this is a good time to ask you to go there. It's www.thecommentarytrack.com. And remember to type in thecommentarytrack.com. If you do it without the, you just get some other movie website that I cannot in good conscience support. But mine, thecommentarytrack.com, oh, it's a wonderland of great things. I have listed all of the books that I have that are easily available for sale. Some of them, you can order them directly from me. And I will even autograph them if you choose to have me deface them with pen and ink. And those you will see that there are there's a PayPal link, so you can just click on those, write a note to me, and tell me how you want it autographed if you do, and then I will send it right out. The ones that I don't have copies of myself, I've put Amazon links so that you can go to Amazon. Now, this is very important, and I'm sure if you listen to any podcast like I do, I listen to lots of podcasts, you'll find that a lot of people do this. So I'm telling you to ignore all those other people and listen only to me because if you go through my site, when you buy something on Amazon, then Amazon will give me just a little bit of cash back. And when I say a little bit, I mean a real little bit. However, it adds up. And if I can get enough people to just genuinely and without thinking about it, go through Amazon to buy whatever you're going to buy, doesn't cost you an extra penny. There's no surcharge for doing this. It's exactly what you would pay if you just went straight to Amazon. But if you go through my site and click on the link, then I will get a little something back. And even though this podcast is free for all, it is not free for me. And so I would very much appreciate any way I can get you people to help support in some way or another. That would be very, very nice, and you'll end up with some nice books. I also put a video page, thinking only of myself, videos in which I've had something in connection. Either I've done a commentary track for them, or appear in a documentary, or something. Sometimes I introduce the film on camera. I don't recommend those because it can get creepy. But I do it, and I do what I'm asked, and in a couple of those, that's what I had to do in order to get a free DVD at the end. So you can go to all of those. I don't sell DVDs myself. I don't have extra copies of any of this stuff, but there are Amazon links for all of them, and there are great films that I've had something to do with. For instance, the newly restored Wings, 1927, the first Academy Award winner. I'm in the documentary attached to that. And for instance, Hondo, McClintock, I did commentary tracks with Leonard Maltin on those. So it just keeps going on. The weirdest one, of course, to me is The Day the Earth Stood Still. I wrote a book about Robert Wise, and so when they called me about doing appearing in a documentary for this Blu-ray, I naturally assumed they were doing a Blu-ray of the Robert Wise film. But no, it turned out they were doing a Blu-ray of the remake with Keanu Reeves, and wanted me to talk about the Wise film in the context of making a documentary about that. Luckily, on the Blu-ray, the Wise film is also represented. And so if you get that Blu-ray, you'll not only get to see me in high def, but you'll get to see me co-starring with Jennifer Connelly, which I feel I was always meant to do. So you can see me in high def. You can see the Robert Wise film. And so that's worth the money right there. And you don't even have to watch the Keanu Reeves remake if you don't want to. And as I recall, a lot of people didn't particularly want to. But I saw it. Not bad. It wasn't bad. But the Wise film is great. So those are ways you can help support the show. And also, whenever I have a guest, for instance, today, Thomas W. Holland, I will put links to his work as well. And sometimes when we have discussions and we talk about a particular film, even though neither I nor my guest really had anything to do with that film, if we talk about it enough within the context of the podcast, I'll put a link to that film as well. Try to make it so that when you go to the website, you can find all sorts of cool things to get. And so you can just buy like crazy, and then the money will come rolling in. And I'll get that bike with a big front wheel even sooner than I thought. My guest, Tom Holland, is, as I said, a really good friend of mine. And I've known him since we were in our 20s. When we met in Atlanta, and we'll talk a little bit about that and give you some biography that you may or may not be interested in knowing. But Tom and I have worked on many projects together. In fact, the first produced scripts I ever wrote were for Tom when we did The Making of It's a Wonderful Life and Frank Capra, A Personal Remembrance. both of which ended up on the It's a Wonderful Life box set, and now is on the DVD and the Blu-ray and everything. Those two documentaries that we made in 1992 just keep a rolling along. I do have a story. We didn't get into this with Tom, but I'll tell you this story quite briefly, because I think that it's interesting in how life works sometime when you're a working writer, and in my case, a sometimes working writer. As you might recall, years ago, for the longest time, It's a Wonderful Life, the great Frank Capra classic, was in the public domain, which meant that anybody could run it and any video company could release it. And that's why for many years, or I would say 20 years, whenever Christmas rolled around, wherever you looked, It's a Wonderful Life was playing on every channel. And no matter how you tried to escape it, you just couldn't, because everybody could run it for free and everybody thought that it was a good thing to keep running. So somebody approached Tom because he was good at sales. That was what he had done before stepping out to start producing. They thought that he could produce a making-of show about It's a Wonderful Life so that somebody could release the film and have a little value added, and it wouldn't be just like all the public domain copies out there. So Tom asked me to write it, and we produced it soon after that, and got some good guests like Sheldon Leonard, and then Tom Bosley was the host. And so we made this, I think it's a half hour long, and it's a very nice documentary. And then once it was finished, Tom went about selling it, trying to find somebody who wanted to buy it and package it with the film. And that happened almost immediately. A company bought it, and all was right with the world. My check cleared, Tom got a check, and that's all you can ask for in this life. So a couple of days later, Tom gets a call, and there's another company, and they said, we are interested in buying this making of It's a Wonderful Life that you have for sale. And Tom said, gee, I'm sorry to tell you this, but I already sold it. And the person, God bless him, said, well, that movie's in the public domain, right? Tom said, yep. They said, well, can't you make another one for us? I mean, kind of like it. And Tom said, don't see why not. So he called me and he said, do you want to write another Making of It's a Wonderful Life special? And I said, is there another check coming? And he said, yes. And I said, by golly, I sure do want to write another one. So that one, we decided to take from a different angle, because obviously we had to. But we made contact with Frank Capra Jr. and asked him to host it, and that's how it became Frank Capra, A Personal Remembrance. And we made both of those documentaries really within weeks of each other, and now they're bound together through eternity, apparently, and will always be on every video release of It's a Wonderful Life until somebody gets around to making another making of, and when they do, I hope they hire me to do it. So here's me talking with my good friend Thomas W. Holland, and I hope you'll enjoy it, and I'll see you on the other side. You remember how you and I met?
Yes. It was a long time ago, far, far away. You and I were both living in Atlanta, and I think I ran an ad to you ran an ad to sell some stuff in the Big Reel, which was a film collector's newspaper way back then, long since out of publication. And I remember what the movie was. It was Tron, and I was a 16 millimeter collector and wanted that trailer. So I called you up, and I was ready just to mail a check to you. And you said, "Oh no, no, I live right here in Atlanta. I'll come over and deliver it." Besides, he says, you said, "I want to meet a fellow film collector. They're few and far between." And I was living in a little condo in Marietta, and you came over. You looked exactly the same, by the way. You haven't
exactly
aged a bit.
Same. Yep.
And you came over with your wife, and we sat down and talked. And now that was how many years ago? That's got to be,
I believe that was 1981.
Or 80 or 81.
80 or 81, yeah.
So that's a long time.
Now, what were you doing in Atlanta?
I was with Columbia Pictures Television, and I had been station there to represent them in the South. I sold all of their syndicated programming, like Charlie's Angels and Starsky and Hutch, the Three Stooges. And I was only in Atlanta for really a couple of years, I seem to recall, before getting moved out to Los Angeles. So I'm glad we met down there while I was there.
Well, I remember you moved into a bigger house, and you had a great screening room downstairs.
I did. Yeah, yeah. That, now, I have to remember, this is before, I'm not even sure Betamax existed back then, but this is before home theaters were common. Everybody's got their big screen TV, but I always wanted a little theater in my house, and so I rigged up two 16-millimeter projectors and cut holes in the wall and got a screen, which I thought was huge at the time. It was a piece of 4x6 plywood that I painted white. And six or eight little chairs down in a cold basement. Do you remember that?
I don't remember it being cold.
Well, it was cold.
I liked it. It was very comfortable.
And it was just such a threat. And I was so popular back then because people would say, oh, my gosh, I want to come over to your house and see a movie. It was such a different kind of experience for people back then. And it was great fun. And I've always wished I could get that back. But, you know, surprisingly, I noticed over the year or so that I lived in that house, I had to cut a support beam to cut the holes in the walls for the projector. Yeah. And I noticed over time that that whole wall started to sag. So I'm not sure that house is even standing anymore. But that's another.
Yes, there's now that this is going to be on the internet.
Uh-oh. You might want to edit
a lawsuit is going to be coming your way. Yeah, I remember that theater very well. We saw you had a scope print of the Ghost of Mr. Chicken.
Oh, my gosh. That's
and
right.
And we saw – you showed me what's the Diana Rigg James Bond movie?
On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which I've never seen.
It was fun, wasn't
yeah,
it?
That's
now,
movie.
I won't name names, but I remember you worked for a certain film depot at the time down there, and you were permitted every once in a while mm-hmm. to – take a print home to watch it before it was released. And I remember you brought a few films over that had not even hit theaters yet.
We had, that was a nice perk of working for non-theatrical film distributors at 16-millimeter prints, because we could always take home whatever we wanted from the thing. Once I was at Films Incorporated in Atlanta, and they had a great screening room. Do you remember that screening room?
I remember. I had never seen Walt Disney's Peter Pan, or hadn't seen it since I was a kid. And I got so excited because you asked your bosses if it would be okay to screen it one day in the screening room, and it was great fun.
We had almost every night that I wasn't doing something else, I would just mount a print onto one of those big 6,000-foot reels and put it in that screening room and just watch it, or sometimes friends and I would watch something together. It was a great.
Well, of course, for your listeners, you know what happened is that 16 millimeter originally started as a school format, something relatively easy to run. The military used it. But theaters at the time all used 35 millimeter film, much double the width. And that stuff was kind of hard to find back in those years. And also the projectors to run it were huge. So that was the attraction to 16 millimeter. But when home video came out big time, especially when VHS hit, interest in 16 millimeter started waning. And today, I mean, there are still collectors, but there's really only a handful who have extensive 16 millimeter collections, because you can't. It's so hard to beat Blu-ray. Blu-ray looks about as good as 35 millimeter film when it's projected on a relatively small screen. The big advantage to running 16 millimeter is that you can find esoteric things that aren't available on Blu-ray and never will be. There's just great discoveries to be made when you start looking into old 16 millimeter films, old animation that nobody seems to care about anymore. That's just spectacular, and movies that will never see the light of day again are still available on 16 millimeter.
Yeah, it's that's always been the trouble with home video, is that it's got to have a market,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of these things just don't have
mm-hmm.
a market.
Mm-hmm.
So it's great that some of the places like Warner Brothers, the Warner Brothers Archive, has been putting out things that they'll do, you know, print one at a
yes,
time
when
you
get that's great, yes.
And that's certainly helping. That's certainly opening up things that we might not otherwise see.
Yeah.
But there's still – I've got stuff on LaserDisc that has never been released on DVD or Blu-ray.
Yeah.
So that's why I keep the LaserDisc.
Sure. Around. Sure. Well, there's another kind of sad side to the whole story in that a lot of those old esoteric films were remembered by old esoteric people, and they are slowly dying off.
Yeah.
So some of the real obscure stuff is really, really hard to find these days. And I remember my dad, when I was a little kid, who had a 9-to-5 job, staying up till 2 and 3 in the morning to watch the Late, Late, Late Show on television just to see an old movie he remembered from his childhood. And then he'd be wiped out the whole next day, but he saw his movie. And today when, you know, you program your TiVo or you don't even think twice about it. And I'm sure you do too, or about the same age, is rushing home to see something on TV. Usually the one TV that was in the house that the whole family gathered around. Now everyone's got their own TV, it seems, in households. But, those were different times.
Yeah, this is our generation's stories of walking through 6 feet of snow.
6 feet of snow to get to school, that's right.
we couldn't record anything.
No.
If something came on, you had to see it when it was on or you didn't see it.
Well, I was always an early adopter of a lot of those technologies, and I used to love – I was the first to be able – and of anybody I knew to have a video recorder in my house where I could record things off – television. This would have been about 1976 because I remember I had an old 3/4-inch U-matic deck that I used in my business too, but I hooked it up to record off the air. And I remember it was 1976 because I recorded a bunch of the bicentennial celebrations
wow.
that were on. And people would come over weeks later and I'd say, hey, do you remember this? And push the button. People were amazed.
That is early.
That's very early, 1976.
Yeah, because I didn't get my first VHS probably until 81 or mm-hmm. 82, something like that.
I started a little company out of the dining room, my brother and I, where we found public domain things, trailers and such, and we would get a master 3/4-inch of that, usually an hour-long program or so, and we would dub them onto Betamax because VHS hadn't even been invented. And we had a nice little company going there for a while selling Betamax. But there's a lot of people who are early adopters and of that kind of technology. Plus, when you mix in the people's love of movies and of history, people will search out that kind of stuff just to remember something from their childhood or the past.
What's the first thing that got you interested in movies?
I remember specifically. It was, my first movie experience I remember scared the heck out of me, and it could have diverted my career. My mom took me to a matinee of Snow White. It was one of the re-releases, Disney's re-releases. And I remember when that witch came out, when it was dipping the apple in the poison, I remember diving under my seat. But after I got over that, after some therapy, and I got over that, this is a wacky thing. My dad worked for the health department for the city of Philadelphia. My dad had no understanding of mechanical stuff of any kind. So he was given the task of showing this movie about rat control. Not rat patrol, rat control
yeah.
to civic groups around the city. And they gave him an old Bell & Hall 16mm projector and this one reel of film about rat control. And it made my dad so nervous because he brought this projector home, and I remember he had it on the kitchen table, and he had the instruction book open, and he was completely bamfoozled by the whole thing, and he couldn't figure out how to thread the film, and he couldn't get it started. Well, I came in, and I loved it. Instantaneously, I thought, this is for me. It's not only something visual, but it's something mechanical I can kind of fool with, and I love the smell of the engine running, and I love the whole showmanship aspect of it. So we got it running that night, and the whole family gathered around the living room, and we watched this 10-minute short on rat control maybe 5-6 times. So even to this day, if you have any questions, Frank, about rat control,
I do have some.
You ask me. So that was really my first. In fact, my mom snapped a picture of me with this projector. I looked just like Pee Wee Herman standing. I must have been Sunday because I had my little gray plaid suit on, my red bow tie, standing next to this old 16mm projector. And that's still a very fond memory for me. And I think that's where I got the bug.
Did you have access to Castle Films? And
yes, but Frank, do you remember? Those were expensive. Castle Films were sold in department stores and camera shops, and they were put out, I think, by the Universal Company. So most of them were cut-downs of Universal Films, like there'd be Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein and some of those things, as 7 or 8 minute versions of the feature film on 8mm. And I used to see those on the shelves in the department stores and just drool. But the prices were really, really high relative to the times. You could get a little 3 minute cut down in black and white that was maybe $3.95. But for a 12-year-old in those years, that was a lot of money. And my folks never got it, never understood why I would want something like that. But eventually, when my family saved up the money to get our own little 8mm camera and projector, which I'm glad we did because I still have those wonderful home movies from the early 60s and all through the 60s, we invested in one or two of the little Castle films. And then, of course, there were knockoff companies like Carnival Films and others that just did real cheesy cartoons. And I had a couple of those, too, so... But I still see Castle Films to this day, a box on eBay or at a flea market, and just flip out. You know, it just zooms me right back to those years and how exciting just the box art was, just the art on those boxes.
Yeah, I love those things. I never had them. Never had them.
No kidding.
I got one in my life, and it was a Three Stooges short. The castle title was Grips, Grunts, and Groans. And for the life of me, I can't remember what the real title is. It's the one where Curly is a wrestler, and they have to calm him down by tickling his chin with a feather.
Was that Calling All Curs?
It could be. It could be.
I love the Three Stooges titles.
That's the only one I ever had. But luckily, I found once I started realizing that there was such a thing as silent movies, and that it was interesting to me to look into this. That our local library in Spartanburg, South Carolina, had Castle Films Black Hawk Films on 8mm.
Wow.
And so we had an 8mm projector at home.
Holy, and you could take these
just
home?
Just take them home and watch
them. Oh, wow.
So that was the greatest thing.
I would have loved that.
Yeah. And, you know, I was just talking about this with somebody the other day, that I get real whiny about how people... watch a movie on their iPhone or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
And you think, you idiot.
Right. Where's the movie experience?
Just grow up. But then I started thinking, well, we got interested in movies from really inappropriate ways to see them.
Good point.
Like these Castle films
were
silent, really severely cut down versions.
Oh, yeah. Grainy
of feature films. And it was nothing like, but for some reason, the magic of it grabbed us. Mm-hmm. And that was
a very good point. Are you saying that maybe some teenagers watching a movie on his cell phone may end up,
yeah, I think so,
getting a love of the big, yeah.
Yeah. I you never can tell what's going to grab you. Because
very interesting.
You know, it's as you well know, as everybody who's ever met me knows, it was seeing Beau Geste on TV that started me in seriously being interested in film. And I only saw the last half of that movie on a local channel filled with commercials.
Mm-hmm.
Why in the world did that snap something in my brain, but it did.
Well, you know, the impact, I think the impact of motion pictures and those, and kind of any kind of a long form story that you see on a screen, especially in a dark theater where it really gets right to the key parts of your brain, can be very impactful in people's lives. And you and I both worked with Tony Curtis on a television series one time. And I remember, I don't think he actually spoke these words to me, but I remember reading somewhere that he had said that it was going to movies that kind of made him the person he was. And it was watching Cary Grant, Fred Astaire. And he was just a kid in Brooklyn, I guess, or somewhere growing up in a New York suburb with very little money. And going to those movies showed him that there was a whole different side of life, whole different kind of people. And I've always remembered those words, and I, to some extent, I feel the same way, that watching movies, especially the ones that meant something to me, really can help form your personality.
I think so, too. And it's also, I get, the other thing that frustrates me is when people won't watch older films or won't watch foreign films or any, will close themselves off from anything. That annoys me. Because it seems to me that movies are the greatest way to travel through time, to travel around the world, to live experiences that you will never live in your real life.
That's true.
And not only fantastic things like Star Wars or fantasy, but a movie about somebody in Africa or a movie about just places that you will never go and experiences that you will never have because of movies. You can, to some extent, share these things and learn about these things. I mean, it's whenever I watch a movie from the past, and it always is as much about that time and place as it is about whatever the movie's
about.
That's
so true.
I was just recently watching a Bob Hope movie called Bachelor in Paradise, which
I know it very well. I know it.
One of his classic films.
Yeah,
it's not very good at all.
Yeah.
However, all that footage of the early San Fernando Valley.
I mean, Frank, I was
like
just going to comment
60s,
on that.
San Fernando Valley, and at one point he goes into a supermarket. I think it's an Albertsons. He just goes in to do some. And it's, you know, typical gag of this bachelor who has no idea how to shop and that kind of stuff. Because God knows men have no idea what to do in a store.
Of course not.
But he goes into this Albertsons, and the gags aren't funny. But the sequence, it's 1960 or 61, and there's this supermarket. It's not a set. It's a real place. And
you see the real products from those years and the real prices.
And it's just, to me, that's just fascinating.
Yeah, I
can imagine why that's not fascinating to everybody.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that because I grew up in Philadelphia, and I'm not saying it wasn't, you know, it was a slum or anything like that, but it certainly was a lower middle class neighborhood. And to me, living in California, particularly the San Fernando Valley, was a dream. And so, and I knew early on what that was all about. I knew that movies were made in California and in Los Angeles, and I knew that a lot were filmed in the Valley. And so I would watch for movies that had those scenes. Another one, just as you were saying that comes to mind is Jerry Lewis's Disorderly Orderly.
Oh, yeah.
Where the bad guy's strapped to the gurney and he's rolling down the hills. That was filmed right over in Studio City. And a lot of the places that are in that film, that was 1964, are still there. And every time I drive by, I think, wow, you know, I was 12 years old or 11 or whatever when I watched that and wishing I could be there. And here I am.
I feel the same way every time I'm on the Warner Brothers lot. Because when I was a little kid, there were all those Warner Brothers westerns on TV, Cheyenne and Maverick and Sugarfoot and just a ton of them.
Oh, yes.
And every one of those shows would start with this aerial view of the Warner Brothers
I remember that.
Studio in Burbank. And I swear to you, I am never there without thinking about that. At least it flashes to me at some point that when I was 5 and 6 years old watching Maverick, and here I am.
Now, isn't that a weird feeling?
I'm walking in this place.
Warner Brothers memory is I convinced... I read in our local paper in Philadelphia that Universal Studios was going to start their tour. So this would have been late 1964, I guess. Well, once I heard that, I thought, wow, I could actually get onto a movie lot. That was an unbelievable possibility to me. So I started pushing my parents into the possibility of let's drive across the country, because flying was out of the question, financially. But let's drive across the country and let's make that a vacation and we'll go to Universal. And we did. We ended up going there. And I remember the road up to Universal when they just opened that tour was dirt road. And we got up to the top and it was much more fun in those days because it wasn't set up like an amusement park. It was set up like a real movie studio. So we were led into various sound stages and we got to watch some of the filming. I walked onto the set of the Munsters, which was in production, and John Wayne's The Hellfighters. I was all over that set. Of course, the biggest thrill was I was standing on the sidewalk and who walks right by me but Don Knotts.
Wow.
He was filming The Ghost of Mr. Chicken there. And we ended up sitting in the booth next to him in the commissary. Now, again, I was about 12 or 13, and it was a huge, big deal for me. But I wanted to see what the other studios looked like. So I had an uncle who lived here, and, he stuck me in his pickup truck and he said, come on, I'm going to go show you a couple of the other studios. I can't get in, but you can see them from the outside. Well, Frank, as you know, there's high walls and hedges around these. So he drove me over at Warner Brothers, where there was a hedge that must have been 10 feet high. And I remember he put me on his shoulders and he said, can you see anything over the top? Well, I couldn't. But just the thrill of standing there was something I'll never forget. Those are kind of things that, as an adult, you'll never approach those excitement levels as you do when you're kids. And that's why I think if you have kids, it's really great to try and expose them to as many of those memorable things as possible.
Yeah, those things have huge impact. And I never got out to California until I was an adult.
So
I never knew. But the only movie thing to me was when I was 11 years old. We were in Texas to see the Alamo, which was a dream of mine. And my parents took me down to Brackettville to see the set where John Wayne
made
that film.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of others.
And that was, to me, the most magical thing I'd ever seen. Because I can imagine. It was a wreck, and it looked like you had just gone out in the middle of nowhere and found this old fort. And so that was really something to me.
Frank, do you remember the time you were working over at Disney for a while? And I don't remember the circumstances, but this was a long time ago. And you invited me to come over for lunch because I wanted to eat at the commissary, their mm-hmm. little commissary there, which is gone. But it was great fun in those days. And you showed me around. And in those days, they still had the back lot.
Yeah.
And we walked all through the back lot and very exciting to see but the neatest part was we turned a corner where there's a parking lot today, but it was where they had filmed scenes of Zorro.
Yeah.
And it was a little Spanish village built along the side of a soundstage, as I recall, but it had a straw roof and old tiles. And to think that must have been, 1980 or so, 81, I don't remember when that was. But that was a TV series that was shot in the late 50s, the mid 50s. And that was still standing there. I doubt there are too many circumstances in Los Angeles today where you'd find a standing set, no. That's still used. It's 30, 40 years old.
No, when I worked at Disney only very briefly, and that was in the mid 90s.
Oh, maybe it was then.
Although I think you and I went to that set earlier than that.
I don't recall.
But, where the office I was in looked right out onto a town square that was used in several films. More, I think, Something Wicked This Way Comes is the one that comes to mind. And it was used in some scenes in Chaplin, the Richard Attenborough film, and so forth. But they were tearing that down while I was working there. And my window looked right out onto that set.
Mm.
And so day by day, I watched it go away.
Yeah.
And now there's just a big...
It's kind of sad. I think you'll agree with me that it's only recently that Los Angeles has paid any attention to its architectural history and its huge history in the film business. This tends to be a business where the film executives and the people who run studios are and maybe rightly so, are interested in what they're doing at the moment and what their paycheck is and what their bonuses are and what the, you know, how a film does at the box office. And there's virtually no interest in history. There's many, many horror stories of studios that just threw away their old negatives or let them rot. I know of one unnamed studio that rented a bowling alley in New York, outside of New York City, to store 35 millimeter negatives and prints in, and they locked the door and walked away. The bowling alley had huge holes in the ceiling, and the water was gushing in. And I think, why this is history. This is American history. Why would you throw something like that away? And however, there are people like Scorsese and Spielberg and others who in recent years have made an effort to try and recover some of that history. But boy, a lot of it's already gone. As you know, there's so many lost films that we'll just never see again.
Yeah. And lost places. You know, if you live in Boston, as I have, or Philadelphia, as you have, you can drive around and you say, oh, look, there's the Old North Church, mm-hmm. and let me take you to Bunker Hill.
And they're still standing.
And there they are. If you're in Los Angeles, the best you can do, basically, is to drive around and say, well, the Intolerance set used to be there. The Griffith Studios used to be there.
Mm-hmm.
All you can do is go around and say where things used to be, by and large.
In many ways, it's a throwaway. It was considered, and maybe still is, a kind of a throwaway business, a business that creates a product that's frivolous in a lot of people's minds. And I guess you don't know when you're making a movie if it's going to end up being a classic or not. But it is sad, and I understand the realities. You can't keep it the set of Intolerance wherever it was at Hollywood and Vine sure. standing from the 20s. But I feel sorry for Debbie Reynolds. Tried for years to open a Hollywood museum, and that with her own money she went and she bought props and clothes and wardrobe and built. She built a massive collection, and then spent decades looking for someone to put up the money to open a museum. And here, nobody was interested. Nobody. Nobody backed, nobody helped her. And it's very sad. And that, by the way, as you know, her collection was auctioned off not too long ago, and a lot of it has left the country. There's, by the way, in some places, like France and Germany, where there's a much greater appreciation of American film history than there is here.
Yeah, it's really shocking how disposable all that stuff is when it seems like treasures to us.
Maybe we're too early. Maybe it's too early. Maybe Hollywood needs another 100 years to discover that's important stuff. But by that time, it may be too late.
But you know, there are still places around if you know where to look. Like the steps from Laurel and Hardy's, the music box are still there. The Max Sennett Studios is now a storage unit, but if you look at it, the shape of the building is still the same. It's still there. So it's funny. Just last week, we watched Laurel and Hardy's Big Business.
You know, my favorite. Yes.
They're playing Christmas tree sales.
Yes, of course.
And that house is over in Chevy O'Hills.
No kidding. It's still there.
Still there. But the wonderful thing about that is that the house is still there, and it looks very similar to the way it did. They fixed it back up after Laurel and Hardy had their way with it. But the great thing about that is when you watch that movie, every time the camera turns from that house, there's like nothing there.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
And there are other houses around, but they're scattered, and there's vast areas of nothing. Mm. And that stuff is just fascinating to me. And same like when we were talking about Bachelor in Paradise, the same thing there. Mm-hmm. He comes over. I can't remember exactly where he is, but Van Nuys or
it's an unnamed suburban community, upscale.
But I know. I mean, they filmed it in Chatsworth. I think.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But. Same thing there. You go and you see this cul-de-sac where he moves in, and it's just emptiness all around there. Mm-hmm. And that was, in terms of history, not all that long ago.
No, Frank, you told me a story one time, and I don't remember the principles in the story. but it was someone who you had met, an old movie star, who talked about when they first came out to California and they got off the train. And they got off the train, I think, in Pasadena, which was, I think, at the time, the closest to get into the Los Angeles area. And they said the first thing that hit them was the smell of orange blossoms, that everywhere you went, it smelled like orange blossoms because they were orange groves.
Yeah.
They were orange groves with an occasional studio plopped down the middle of them.
Yeah, and it must have been like paradise.
Yeah, it must have been because that would have been before the big air pollution thing that happened in L.A. Must have been clear skies and just warm weather and paradise.
But remember, when I was – I did a book several years ago called Los Angeles Uncovered.
Mm-hmm, I remember.
It was part of a series of X Uncovered books. And I found that when the first European settlers came to this basic area – looked over what is now basically Los Angeles, there was a huge brown cloud floating over the area. And they even called it something like the Land of Smoke.
Oh, my gosh.
And so...
are you saying that our pollution problems have been around? It was all those Chumash fires, I guess. I don't know.
It's just one of those things. When I lived in Boise, Idaho for a year... which is not a heavy polluter city.
I wouldn't think so.
But because of the way the mountains ring around it, there's always a layer of smog over the city.
Well, a few minutes ago I talked about that family vacation we did in Los Angeles in 1965, and we didn't have air conditioning in our station wagon back then. And I can remember driving over the Cahuenga Pass, and my eyes burned and watered beyond – I couldn't breathe. And I think you'll agree with me, though, Frank. We have really cleaned up the air in Los Angeles, and we take a bad rap for smog. And we have some of the toughest air pollution laws in the world here, and it's really helped, really, really helped. I no longer see that yellow haze that I used to see even a few years ago.
Yeah, I've seen films from the early '60s, and it just looks like the whole town is on fire.
Yeah,
it's just covered with smog and. Yeah, I mean, I'm looking out the window of your house right now, and it's clear as a bell.
Yeah,
it's beautiful out here.
Yeah, so. You know, you mentioned a few minutes ago you were talking about kids people not being interested in older films and black and white films, and it reminded me that for a while I guess this is shameful to say, I was one of the pioneers in the colorization. Of black and white films.
I never held it against you.
This is when the technology first came out and Columbia Pictures Television made a deal with one of the colorization companies. And next thing I know, I'm out trying to pitch this stuff. And, you know, we had moderate success, but there were times when people would throw things at me and even in my heart of hearts, I had trouble with the concept. But, It is kind of unfortunate when they've done studies that show that if you run a mix of color and black and white films, people just tune out when they see black and white. It doesn't matter what the content is. Mentally, they just go away. And I think it's because the mind is so stimulated by the color and of course the newness that goes along with a color film. That they're just not interested in black and white. This project that I just did, this Christmas project called Santa's Cool Holiday Film Festival, has a whole pre-show of a mix of vintage Christmassy type cartoons and old theater snipes and that sort of thing. And I went to watch it in a theater not long ago where there were some young children. And I was kind of watching the kids more than I was watching what was going on the screen because I'd seen it a million times. But it proved itself. The children just immediately got bored and started running around when black. And it's kind of sad. And I don't know how you resolve that. When my kids were little, I tried showing them as much black and white as I could. And I think they kind of got used to it. I even used to run the old B-Westerns for them. And I guarantee... that my kids were the only children in their elementary school who knew who Gabby Hayes was.
Yeah, I remember your daughter, Emily, told me that one time, and she didn't seem altogether pleased by that. She was like, it didn't seem like something she was proud of.
It's expanding their education.
It really was. Well, I think that's part of if kids have to be exposed to it early on to get used to the reality of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that was one of the advantages of our growing up when we did, was that TV was pretty much equally black and white in color. You'd see a lot of black and white movies, and you'd still a lot of black and white shows in syndication. Yeah. By the time I was 12 or so, most TV was in color, but it was black and white was still pretty much a fact of life.
Yeah.
And so it never seemed like a liability to me one way or the other.
I feel the same way, but it is. But I think I'm afraid that it is.
Yeah, it's because the kids aren't watching black and white.
The perception is, no. Oh, that's old and dull. No. And ironically, the films that when I'm by myself and it's late at night or a rainy Sunday and I want to just relax on the couch and watch something, inevitably it's something black and white. I just feel that black and white films are, first of all, I think they're harder to make because you don't have a color palette to work with, but you're far more concerned with shadows and lighting, and I appreciate them far more. I just love getting into an old black and white film, and as you said a minute ago, I like looking. I can watch a film a million times, and the rest of my family doesn't understand this. And I say, I'm not watching it for the storyline. I know what the storyline is. Maybe it's a stupid storyline. I'm watching it because I love the feeling that it gives me. I love to look beyond it. I like to look at the cars and the street scenes. I like to look at all that kind of stuff. That's what fascinates me. To me, that's like a time machine.
I never understood exactly where that came from to me, because I can remember very early on when I was just a kid, when something would come on TV and it seemed to be really old, like a Helen 12 Trees movie would come on, and that would immediately make me want to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I knew that I was seeing something from long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, it was the same thing. When I was a kid, my grandmother would start talking about when she was a child. And I loved listening to all these stories.
Right.
And I remember my cousins and everybody would be sitting around and going, oh, gee, here she goes again. But I love that stuff.
Well, don't you think maybe, Frank, we're probably in the minority that we do appreciate history and we do appreciate, especially oral histories like that. My mom, when she was a young girl, lived in New York in the 40s. And when I think of New York in the 40s, to me, that must have been just a great, great time. Yes, the war was probably going on. I mean, it was going on, and that probably made life more difficult. But when I think back, those to me, that must have just been a spectacular time. I remember her telling me, yes, I had a little brown stone. It was a real cheap little place, and it was on West 57th Street. Well, you know, yeah, where CBS is today. I would love to have been around during those in those days. I too love hearing those kind of stories.
Yeah, it was always attractive to me. And I don't know why. I don't know where that came from, but it just did. And I don't think it was, you know, I never want to sound like I'm saying, oh, the kids today are this or that.
No.
Because I don't think it's the kids today. I think it was always the kids. I think the kids, when I was a kid, were not particularly interested in that stuff.
That's true. Well,
although
most kids our age were watching The Three Stooges, which was black and white.
And Laurel and Hardy and
Our Gang. All of which we knew when we were watching were old films. We knew that they weren't current.
Yeah, but I don't think it occurred to us that much.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that I really dwelled on that. Although, I've always looked at Our Gang and Laurel and Hardy especially because it was not unusual to see their very earliest sound films on TV. So you're looking at films from 1929 and 30.
Right.
And I've always thought that that was a great doorway to serious films of that time. Because the acting is different. I reject people who say that it was worse or anything like that.
It was just a different style.
And it was a much more deliberate way of speaking. Say, you mug. Why I oughta.
Yeah.
But because I was used to it in the comedies, that was because it was, they were funny and they got me into it. Then when I started seeing other films from that period, it wasn't that much of a leap for me. Whereas I dare say if you were to show a 1929 talkie to your average 12-year-old today, they'd have no idea what to make of it.
Yeah, that's true.
Because they'd have no way of stepping into it. It would seem completely foreign to them. So in some ways, I felt like I was educated to it in the most fun possible way through Laurel and Hardy. And especially Our Gang. I love those things. And I still have a special love for those early Our Gangs with Jackie Cooper and Weezer.
I love those. And Miss Crabtree.
And yeah, Miss Crabtree. Yeah, all that. I love that era. Farina, who was one of the funniest of the Our Gangs.
Well, you know, it's, when I think of those, you rarely saw parents in those old Our Gangs. It was the kids were out doing things, building things. And I could tell you the times have changed. I mean, with two kids today being completely internet-based, they're not out and about as much as they used to be. And then there's everyone's fears about, you know, what can happen to your kids if you're not hovering over them every second. I'm sure you remember when you were younger getting on your bike and riding for miles and miles and miles and feeling absolutely safe. And I lived in a city and I felt safe. I never had an incident, never had a problem. And so I kind of related a little bit more to those kids' adventures. And I wonder if children today watch those and think, well, you know, that's I can't even think of a bunch of my friends would get together and build an old go-kart out of wooden boxes. Who would do
fire truck,
So, I don't know.
When did you start deciding you wanted to be involved in actually making movies or being involved in movies itself as opposed to just liking them?
Well, I think I always wanted to. I had took our little 8mm camera and did little stop motion things even as a kid, and I just loved it. Was charmed by it. But as happens to most people, you know, you grow up and you go get in. You find yourself being pulled in different directions, and somehow I got into the distribution and sales side of the film business versus the production side. And maybe I'm lucky because those tended to be jobs which were a lot more steady and a regular paycheck that could go on for a while versus the production side, which is still, I think, one of the riskiest businesses to be in. And it's a young person's business, too, because it takes a lot of energy. And so I was in the distribution business, and I saw how producers would produce what they thought were these little gems that everyone would be standing in line waiting for, turn them over to me and the other sales guys, and we'd say, nobody wants this. You know, and they'd say, well, it was always a problem between the production side of the studio and the distribution side, and never the twain shall meet. Sometimes I think if you really wanted to be successful, it's best to reverse engineer. You go to the salespeople first and you say, you're out there on the street. You're in theaters. What are people talking about? What are they looking for? Okay, let's produce something that, well, that doesn't really happen too much either. And I'm not saying that that would work all the time. But I got real frustrated. And so when the studio started changing some things, I saw a time for me to leave, and I started my own little independent production company. And that was the first time I really had to educate myself right from the beginning about how to get things done quickly and cheaply and something that would be saleable. And my first productions were things that I could actually go out and sell. So I knew that to some extent, somebody would buy them. And that went on for a while. And I did a lot of specials and niche-y type shows, because those are areas where you can compete against the major studios, because they're really not interested in that end of the business. And so the door was kind of open there. After a while, I thought, you know, maybe the time is right to think about doing something theatrically, something that could be really shown, something I could produce that could be shown in a real movie theater. That was always a dream of mine. And besides, the television business was getting just so complex and competitive. So I started a little theatrical distribution company, mostly with public domain films, Night of the Living Dead and some public domain cartoons, and went out, repackaged them, and went out into the marketplace, and I found I loved it because the people who buy movies from me were a completely different type of person that were buying TV shows from me. I was no longer dealing with a committee and multiple opinions. I was dealing with mom and pop theaters a lot, and bookers of small repertory chains who really loved film and loved talking about it and loved what they did. And I clicked with it right away. I thought, boy, this is fun. This is great. Not a whole lot of money in it, but it was really fun and stimulating. And that's kind of how I slid into producing and distributing for theaters. And I started building a library of films that I could book. And then over time started picking up copyrighted films. Things like Reanimator that Brian Yuzna had produced, and another film, great film of his, another real creepy horror classic called Society. And Cassandra Peterson's Who's Elvira, a couple of her films, and then that led to being able to get a sub-license on The Graduate, which did great for me for a while. And so that's kind of how I've slid into the distribution business. But I still love niche-y type things. I don't like competing with the big guys if I don't have to, because that's a real difficult, expensive game. And I can't play it. So I would much rather find something they're not doing, exploit that area and do it well. And so, and now with digital cinema, becoming, more and more widespread, it's opened some incredible doors. I'm sure you feel the same way, Frank. I hate to see film go. I hate to see something that has worked so well so long kind of slowly disappear. But the digital technology that's coming into theaters is really incredible. And on this recent Santa Claus project that I mentioned, there's no way I could have done that as a film-based project. For one thing, I could never afford to strike all of the 35-millimeter prints that would be necessary to get that film into theaters in the month of December. There's just no way. But with digital technology, where the film is finished and then encoded onto a special kind of hard drive and goes to theaters relatively inexpensive. That was just incredible to me.
We've talked a little bit about the Santa Claus, but tell people a little bit more about what it actually was.
Well, there was Frank, I think you actually introduced me to this film. There's a movie called from 1964 called Santa Claus Conquers the Martians, and it's a corny children's film about some Martian children who are very sad, and they figure that the reason they're sad at Christmas time is because Martians have no Santa Claus. So they decide to come to Earth and kidnap our Santa Claus. But have no fear, it has a happy ending, because in the end the Martians find that they actually do have a Santa Claus.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, sorry. And so I remember you brought a DVD over to me years ago, and you said, you got to watch this. It's both charming and corny and silly and I thought it was great.
And so, Pia Zadora is in it.
And Pia Zadora, she's green though.
Yeah.
And because she's a Martian girl. Mm-hmm. And so I had that in the back of my mind to do something with it. But you know, when it was released in 1964, it had such a limited release pattern. I don't think it played in more than 100 movie theaters. Mm. Therefore, there were very few 35-millimeter prints struck. And as far as I know, and I've looked around for a long time, I don't think there's any existing. But I was able to find in Europe a 16 millimeter answer print that had very, very good image quality. It was struck for a television run somewhere over there. Got a hold of this print, and we restored it at Photocam, and it just looked great. It's almost indistinguishable from 35 because of the 35 millimeter because of the resolution. And so I took that and I did this this pre-show that I mentioned earlier, which had a lot of, and put together a 2-hour Christmas program called Santa's Cool Holiday Film Festival, featuring Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. And Frank, it was one of three similar digital compilation projects that I decided to experiment with. Another one was a kind of a salute to the drive-ins, and the other one was a horror type compilation. And this, the Christmas one, I thought was going to be the runt of the litter. I didn't have any expectations for it. I thought I'd get laughed at, and I went out with this thing. I contacted the Landmark Theater chain first, who I have a long relationship with, and they run some of the finest repertory theaters in the country. And they snapped it up immediately. They said, oh, well, this is great. Our college crowd audience is going to love to make fun of this movie. They know it already because it's been spoofed on Mystery Science Theater, and Elvira spoofed it on her movie Macabre series. Anyway, so that right off the bat, I got the Landmark Theaters. And then I started picking up other repertory houses like the Castro in San Francisco and the Music Box in Chicago. But then a weird thing happened. Word of mouth got out on it. And all of a sudden, I started getting bookings from mainstream mall-type theaters that I had never booked anything into. And I thought, wow, well, this is really a fluky thing, because they weren't interested in it to be sarcastic about it. They didn't want to spoof it. They have family audiences, and they thought, well, here's a film that kids will like, and it's something that's innocuous enough where their parents can bring them to the show and not be too annoyed. And, well, I started adding more and more of these mainstream theaters. And then one day, I'll never forget it, I got an email from the Rave theater chain. Rave is one of the largest in the world, maybe. And they own theaters in every major city in the country. Anyway, I got 60-some bookings on that one day alone, all the Rave theaters. Then the next thing I know, one of the theaters in Westwood picked it up, which is, as you know, our big, prestigious area to have a film shown in Los Angeles. Even Grauman's Chinese Theater looked at it for a long time and then finally decided that they didn't have an available screen. But I thought, oh, my God, of all of the films to have my first kind of wide success with, it has to be Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Listen, you get Pia Zadora in something, and you cannot fail. You can't.
Unfortunately, I don't think Pia's too interested. I actually contacted her to see if she wanted to do some kind of, and I never heard back. Mm. So I don't think she's too interested in this film. But anyway, it was just a bizarre circumstance, and I'm not sure that will ever happen again. But we ended up in over 200 theaters, including theaters in Europe. We got a bunch in Ireland. One theater in South Africa picked it up. So I'm as amazed as anyone else. I'm delighted. What I'd love to see happen with this is for the movie to be kind of an annual reissue. Look, it's never going to be It's a Wonderful Life. But maybe it'll be the It's a Wonderful Life for the juvenile set. I don't really know. So anyway, it's been a fun, sometimes nerve-wracking experience.
Now, have you done that completely digital? Did you do any 35 prints? Or?
Oh, yes. Well, as I said, the Santa Claus Conquers the Martians print was 16 millimeter. Yeah. That's all we could find. But it looks great on screen. It's still a film lover's dream, and that it's really obscure bits and pieces of film. Santa Claus Conquers the Martians was a 16 millimeter print, but in the pre-show, which runs about 45 minutes, I'd say three quarters or more of that originated from 35 millimeter, and the Frank, I got to tell you, the technology these days is just unbelievable. I took some footage into Photocam in Burbank, which is one of the leading video and film labs in the world. And they telecine'd some of our footage. I know there was a bit with Sherry Lewis and Lamb Chop where Sherry Lewis gave a Christmas greeting to the theater audience circa 1961. And that film had faded so badly that it was just beet red. And the technology is such now that when they run that when they scan it frame by frame, they get the highest resolution that's possible. They get all the information that's there. And then another kind of computer with an operator who's overseeing it takes over and looks for any hint of color that might be left. Once they find that hint, the computer can tell them what the original coloring was in the frame. It's unbelievable. So when you see that Sherry Lewis and Lamb Chop, you would never know that it wasn't shot yesterday. It's great. Now, if you were to try and do that the old way in an optical film lab, I'm not even sure you could approach that kind of quality, and the expense would be outrageous. Even if you could. So, to me, I'm still a film lover. Don't get me wrong. I still, given a choice, would rather see a film projected properly on from 35 millimeter because it's still the best. But the new digital technology is going to be a boon not only for producers to put things out that wouldn't normally make it to theaters, but for audiences to see things that they would never have been able to see before just because it's too darn expensive to make a 35-millimeter print.
Well, I think that's something in common with a lot of the new technology, including the way we're recording this right now.
Oh, I'm amazed at this.
That we... it opens the door for people like us to do something
yes.
that is more of a niche thing. Because yes. let's face it, how many people are going to be listening to this?
Well,
7.
Well, once they hear that I'm the guest, you can count.
Well, that'll bring it up to 11.
All the Santa Claus Martians Santa fans Claus, will be.
Yes. It's really amazing that you can make films now for a fraction of the cost.
Absolutely.
That you could.
And well, just look at YouTube.
Yeah.
YouTube is unbelievable. Funny story. A couple of years ago, I ended up on YouTube just surfing around one night, and I thought, I'm fascinated by this process where they can take a 2D image and kind of make it 3D. I'd watched some of these History Channel shows where they take an old still or a postcard and the camera actually moves through it. And I knew that it was a process of digitally separating the layers, but I was fascinated by it. And so I got on YouTube and I started looking at some of the examples that were out there. And lo and behold, I found the website of the fellow who actually does those for the History Channel and contacted him and hired him to do my company logo. Mm. Doing it the same way. I had this old postcard from the 30s. It was a shot of Hollywood looking down from the mountain, and there were palm trees in it on both sides. And so he took that postcard and he separated out every element of that picture, every palm tree, every building, everything. And that has become my logo now. When you see it, the camera moves all the way right past all these 6 or 7 palm trees and goes out over Los Angeles and then up to the black sky where it says Holland Releasing. And again, that's not something you could do before digital.
Yeah.
Or it would have to have been completely animated by hand. So I'll state I'm a film fan. I still love it, and when I talk to theaters, they always ask for my opinion. I always tell, particularly the repertory houses, don't throw your 35-millimeter equipment out. You should hang on to that because there will still be a lot of uses for it. Film is not going to disappear overnight. But go ahead and add digital as much as you can.
Yeah.
And I do fear that a lot of the mainstream theaters are just junking their 35-millimeter equipment and going all digital. And I think they might be sorry in the long run at some of the things that they won't be able to get in the future.
Well, in terms of preservation, film is still the best source. Because we don't know what the future will bring on any of this stuff, but film for over 100 years has been solid in terms of...
Absolutely.
When you're restoring something, when you're trying... No matter what you want to do, I mean, you know, if you had been restoring something 40 years ago, you might have put it on 2-inch videotape.
True.
Now, where are you even going to play that, much less restore it? And,
good point.
And, yeah. So, same thing about this stuff that we're doing now. Who knows what's going to happen to digital? Who knows how the technology just keeps changing? But through it all, film is the constant.
And as you know, Frank, all major motion pictures are still archived in some way or another on 35 millimeter film, either as an interpositive or some sort of a negative to this day. So we're not going to see film go away. It's still, as you said, the best archival method. I mean, you can get the amount of information you can get into a 35 millimeter film frame is unbelievable. Just incredible.
Yeah. When I was writing my book on lost films long ago, I remember talking with somebody at the Library of Congress, and we were talking about videotape. And at the time I was writing the book, VHS was what everybody used. It wasn't quite DVD time. And she said, VHS doesn't last any time. She said, if it were up to me, I would get all the VHS tape and transfer it to nitrate film, and it would last a lot longer.
Isn't that true?
Yeah, and it's absolutely true.
Yes.
So we've got, boy, we've been talking for a long time, so we should probably stop. Although we have many more things to talk about.
Oh, I could talk to you about a lot of stuff.
We have not, we've never talked about Hollywood Babylon yet. We haven't talked about the Christmas specials.
Oh my gosh. All the stuff you and I worked on together.
We've worked on so many things. We haven't talked about the Titanic project that nearly ruined both of us.
Yes. Can I tell that story? I'll do a 30-second version.
Sure.
for the listeners who will then understand how hard it is to pitch things in Hollywood. Before James Cameron ever thought of doing a movie on Titanic, Frank approached me and he said, you know, I've been a student of the Titanic and its sinking for decades. And he said, it's a fascinating story. Let me tell you about it. And he told me, and Frank just enthralled me with his just incredible stories about the people on the Titanic and exactly how it sank and all this. And so we thought, gee, this wouldn't it be a great idea to do some sort of a special on the Titanic? And this was right after they discovered Geraldo found Al Capone's vault and did this nationally televised thing. So Frank and I thought, well, you know, we could do sort of the same thing. We'll pull together a psychologist and a medical doctor and a metallurgist, and we'll film it on the Queen. We'll do it live from the Queen Mary talking about the Titanic, and then that led into another type of special. So I'll never forget the day, Frank, you and I. We actually built a model of the Titanic. It was about 3 feet long. And we had our little presentation to show how the ship sank. And we had all of our little stories. And I won't name the production company. It was a major one. And we walk into the pitch meeting. And there was the typical 20-something young woman sitting there who's the gatekeeper who made all the decisions as to whether you were going to go further within the company or not. And we did just a beautiful presentation showing how the ship sank and how it's laying on the bottom and how the baker on the ship managed to survive because he was drunk and all these great, great stories. And do you remember what she said to us?
I sure do.
Her response was, nobody's interested in anything that happened in 1912. And I've got a lunch meeting I've got to go to. But thank you very much.
Yep. And that was 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1998, we found out that people were pretty darn interested.
Yeah. So where is that? Where is that studio exec today?
Oh boy,
she's baking cookies at Mrs. Fields. Or something.
I hope that she's cleaning up after whoever makes the cookies. But. But we have many war stories.
Yes.
So when you come back and you come back on the podcast again.
Uh-oh, part two.
We'll do all those stories. Now, I will have all the links to your books and videos and everything on the website. But tell the good folks at home about how to get in contact with you for your website or...
Well, if they're just interested in seeing what my distribution company is doing, and I deal with theaters, that's HollandReleasing.com. And another time we'll talk about the books and the publishing empire. We call it that.
See, you've got at least two more visits to cover all
of
this.
Oh, that's right. That's
you
right.
And I go way back.
We got, as I know, we have a lot to talk about, and you're a joy to talk to, so anytime.
Well, Thomas W. Holland.
That's right. As opposed to the director, Tom Holland. I always say that's the rich Tom Holland. Yes. I'm the poor Tom Holland.
Well, I like to think of you as the real Tom Holland.
Okay.
So for me and the real Tom Holland, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed my visit with Tom Holland. We're going to come back with him one of these days and talk about some of the horrible things that have happened to us over the course of our mutual careers. But it occurred to me that one thing that I would like to tell you about right now. I told you about the Making of It's a Wonderful Life specials that we did within weeks of each other. And wanted to tell you now about the upshot of one of those experiences. A few years ago, I was writing a lot for The Hollywood Reporter. I wrote many, many stories for The Hollywood Reporter on a freelance basis. And one time they asked me to write many articles for a tribute issue they were doing for about Republic Pictures. And I think I ended up doing 11 feature stories in that issue, all on all aspects of Republic Pictures and where it had been and where it was at the moment and so forth. And it was a fun experience for me, and I got to interview a whole lot of people over there at Republic and got to just dig around in the Republic stuff, and it was fun. But one day I was interviewing one of the mucky mucks over there, whose name I've completely forgotten. This has been 15 years ago or more. I noticed that there was a big box set up on the shelf of It's a Wonderful Life, offering the making of It's a Wonderful Life and Frank Capra, Personal Remembrance. And so, just because I thought it was of interest, and also, let's face it, I wanted a big mucky muck to know that I did stuff, just in case he would ever want me to do stuff, I mentioned conversationally, hey, I wrote both of those documentaries. And he said, clearly impressed, he said, you wrote that It's Making a Wonderful Life? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, I want to tell you that around here, we love that special. We just thought it encapsulated the mood perfectly. It had all sorts of interesting tidbits. It was produced beautifully. We just liked everything about it. And I thought, well, it was nothing. And then he said, you know, we loved it so much that the next time we wanted to do a making of for one of our films, we got somebody to do one just like it. And so I thought, but didn't say, because I did want to maintain a little bit of pride and self-respect. I didn't say, so you wanted something just like something I did, so you hired somebody else to do it. And then I would have had to slap him. So I just didn't go down that avenue or speak to him about that. I just smiled approvingly and thanked him again, and we moved on with our interview. And I never worked for Republic Pictures. Of course I never did, because they loved my stuff. So why would I have ever done anything for them? That's my story in a nutshell. So this has been episode number 2 of the commentary track. I hope you'll join us next week, when our guest is going to be one of the great film historians in the world, Mr. Rudy Bellmer. And I know you're going to enjoy that. I've actually interviewed Rudy twice already. So this is a two-parter, but I'm not going to play them consecutively. But next week is part 1, and I know you're going to like it. I thank you for listening. Please tell people to listen. And please go onto iTunes and give us a nice rating so that we can get to the head of the queue, and people will find out about us and more people will listen. And soon I'll have that bicycle with the big front wheel. That's going to be sweet. So thanks a lot. Thanks for listening. Don't worry. We're going to fix this in post. Thank you.